You're listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 26th of April 2024 on Monocle Radio. Hello and welcome to The Briefing, coming to you live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Muller. Coming up on today's programme...
There's no substitute, in our judgment, for face-to-face diplomacy in order to try to move forward, but also to make sure that we're as clear as possible about the areas where we have differences.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has China's list of red lines read to him. Boeing's first quarter results merely bad as opposed to the anticipated dreadful. A wrap-up of the day's business news and...
Do not be fooled by our politeness. Our bows are made of rituals. Death is in our air.
A look at what you could be watching this weekend. That's all coming up right here on The Briefing on Monocle Radio. Welcome to today's edition of The Briefing with me, Andrew Muller. The United States and the People's Republic of China are once again attempting to decide how much they dislike each other. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is in Beijing, where his opposite number, Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi, welcomed him much as the local protection racket might welcome a new business to the neighborhood. Quote, should China and the United States keep to the right direction of moving forward with stability or return to a downward spiral? Joining me to discuss how one even begins answering that question is Isabel Hilton, founder of China Dialogue and a visiting professor at King's College London's Lau Institute. Isabel, what would have happened if Blinken had said, I'll take the downward spiral, please?
Well, then he certainly wouldn't get a meeting with Xi Jinping. We're still not, that still hasn't been confirmed, but he would be on the naughty step. I mean, the Chinese have taken a pretty robust view of this visit. As you know, they've issued, the foreign ministry issued a very long statement in fairly unfriendly terms, saying this is how you're to behave while you're here. And if you do, well, OK, we can carry on talking. Oh, but by the way, it's good to talk, but if you go on saying one thing and doing another, that's not good enough. So it's pretty undiplomatic stuff, and I doubt there's going to be huge progress on either side, frankly. I
mean, before we get to today's meeting, if we measure the current situation against, I don't know, the last decade or so, how good or bad are things between Beijing and Washington?
Compared to a decade ago, very bad. Compared to 2 years ago, even a year ago, marginally better. Not in the sense that any of the structural issues have been resolved, but with, at least they're talking and agreeing to manage their differences. Both sides have said, look, we are going to have differences. It's important not to let these get out of control. But on the margins of those statements, things continue to happen. China's behavior vis-a-vis the Philippines in the South China Sea has been extremely provocative recently. And this particular Philippines government is an ally of the United States, unlike the previous one. So, you know, the talk goes on, but the provocations continue. And on the U.S. side, there's more and more robust rhetoric over trade issues, over, you know, what should be banned, over sanctions, over Xinjiang. Support for Taiwan. So, you know, talking just about holds it together for now. And so these visits do matter. But we shouldn't really tick off the scorecard of achievement beyond that.
Wang Yi, Chinese foreign minister, has been keen to set out what he described as red lines on areas like sovereignty, security and development. I mean, what is, to narrow this vague conceptualization down somewhat, what is an example of a red line that China will not tolerate the United States crossing?
Well, the prime one is Taiwan. That's the first red line in the statement. It must not be crossed. Taiwan is part of China. The Taiwan question is China's internal affair. And you know, that's the one they're saying, we can do what we like over Taiwan. Just stay out of it. It's none of your business. Now, of course, that's a direct challenge. You know, China, Taiwan has a treaty relationship with the United States. It has a big economic and political relationship with the United States. So... To say we can do what we like and you can't interfere is a bit of a red rag. That's not something the U.S. could accept. Beyond that, human rights in Xinjiang, the question of slave labor, Tibet, you know, those are the traditional ones. But there's a wider picture here, which is that China is seeking to redefine the global definitions of human rights, in the sense that now they talk about universal human rights with air quotes around the universal. And they're essentially saying you cannot interfere in the internal affairs of another country, starting with China, but also as a proposition for the world, which radically rewrites the UN approach.
But on the subject of Taiwan in particular, I mean, Wang Yi knows that that's all nonsense, doesn't he? He knows that the United States is very invested in Taiwan and certainly is interfering by any definition that China would apply. There was, of course, more aid to Taiwan in this much delayed package, including the $61 billion in aid for Ukraine that was recently passed by Congress.
Indeed, China knows that the United States isn't going to stay out of Taiwan, but China is just hardening up the position. I mean, China used to say, we advocate for a peaceful resolution of Taiwan. Now it's far more robust. And by laying down these markers, by saying that peace on the Taiwan Straits and, quotes, Taiwan independence are as irreconcilable as fire and water, they're basically saying if anything happens in the Taiwan Straits, it's the fault of the United States, or if anything happens on Taiwan proper, for that matter, it's the fault of the United States, rather as they do in Ukraine, where essentially they blame Ukraine's supporters for adding fuel to the fire, rather than, you know, rather than Russia for invading in the first place.
Well, on which subject, Blinken did turn up in Beijing with kind of a riot act of his own. He has said that in his meeting with Xi Jinping, he did challenge him on China's support for Russia. Is there really any hope of, if not the United States actually prizing China and Russia apart, then encouraging China to see that Russia is perhaps not the winning side to be on?
Well, I think the difficulty there is that I don't think Xi Jinping can afford to see Putin lose in any major way, or Putin to lose his position, and losing the war might, you never quite know where that ends. So what China's trying to do is to stop the negative consequences for China becoming too great, while taking careful note of the limitations of what the United States can do, because beyond supporting the military effort in Ukraine and imposing sanctions, we've seen that those sanctions are full of holes, particularly if countries like India and China put their mind to getting around them, as they have. So the fact that China supplies dual-use technologies to Russia, they're not actually directly supplying arms, but they are enabling Russia to rebuild its military industrial base. And those dual-use technologies, such as drones, have been critical in the war itself. So it's pretty, it's pretty blatant sanctions busting in spirit, if not in law. Now, the threat that the United States is bringing in Blinken's briefcase is that if this goes on, the United States will sanction China's financial institutions, the banks. And this is another arena of contestation which is going to go on getting worse. So the U.S. control of the dollar and therefore of international transactions is a pretty powerful weapon. But when deployed against Russia, as it has been, what has happened is that China and Russia are now doing their trade denominated in renminbi, in the Chinese currency, the same with Iran. And China's trying to build up alternatives to the SWIFT system and partly to insulate itself from any sanctions that might arise from Taiwan. So the more that threat is dangled, the more China will make efforts to build alternative systems and to sanction, for example, a major state-owned Chinese bank would be a kind of declaration of financial war, and that would be a very serious situation.
Isabel Hilton, thank you as always for joining us. You are listening to The Briefing. Here is Monica Lillis with the day's other news headlines.
Thanks, Andrew. Haitian Prime Minister Ariel Henry has resigned, paving the way for a transitional council to lead the embattled country. The 9-member transitional council, where 7 members will have voting powers, is expected to help set the agenda of a new cabinet. The South Korean government has denied being responsible for the disastrous 25th World Scout Jamboree last year, after being held to blame by investigators. Last summer, tens of thousands were evacuated from the campsite due to problems with the food and medical facilities. A huge black barrier to block Mount Fuji from view will be installed in a popular photo spot by Japanese authorities, exasperated by crowds of badly behaved foreign tourists. Construction of the mesh net, 2.5 metres high, and the length of a cricket pitch at 20 metres, will begin as early as next week. Those are the day's headlines. Back to you, Andrew.
Thank you, Monica. You are listening to The Briefing on Monocle Radio with me, Andrew Muller. Time now to take a look at the latest business news with the head of investment at Interactive Investor, Victoria Scholar. Victoria, first of all, a rise in shares in Google's parent company, better than expected earnings. Do we understand why they were better than expected?
Yeah, a pretty huge rise, actually, more than 11% in terms of the surge in Alphabet's share price. I think it was partly due to the fact that its earnings beat expectations, but it was also because the company reported its first ever dividend worth almost $2.5 billion, which investors are clearly very happy about. And looks like its valuation looks set to surge past $2 trillion. The company is also returning cash to shareholders, not just through the dividend, but also through a $70 billion share buyback. So it's a major payday for Alphabet's investors. In terms of the results, we know that revenue jumped 15%, outpacing expectations. The company's CEO, Sundar Pichai, said that it was a strong performance for search, YouTube, and cloud. And Google was well underway in artificial intelligence.
I mean, good news elsewhere in the tech sector as well. A strong set of results from Microsoft. Are these related phenomena in any respect?
Yes, absolutely. Both companies are heavily invested in artificial intelligence, which is a huge market theme and has been propelling gains across the tech sector, with companies like Nvidia staging incredibly strong share price performances over the last 12 to 18 months. But we've seen that shares in Microsoft jumped by more than 4% after it reported earnings that beat expectations, revenue hitting nearly $62 billion, and that's because of billions in investment into AI, particularly in cloud computing, where revenue surged by 20%. And its CEO, Satya Nadella, said that Microsoft's AI tools are orchestrating a new era of AI transformation, driving business outcomes across every role and industry.
Is there any caution discernible in the market where these AI-led surges in shares are concerned? This would not be the first tech bubble which has popped when it proved something short of what was expected.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And there's no doubt that valuations have got pretty ahead of themselves. And that's why we have seen some stocks correcting in recent weeks. We've seen huge share price gains for the likes of Microsoft, Meta, Nvidia and others. And so I think investors are thinking that stocks are pretty expensive right now. So it wouldn't be surprising to see more of a correction.
And just finally, another topic that will have been raised in the meetings between US Secretary of State Anthony Blinken and his Chinese hosts is the future of TikTok. There has been some sort of announcement from its parent company about whether it's going to do what the US is telling it.
Yes, and it looks like the parent company isn't going to do what they're telling it to. China's tech giant ByteDance insists that the company has no plans to sell TikTok after the US passed a law to force the sale of the business or else ban the social media company altogether stateside. TikTok said it's planning to challenge the unconstitutional law in court after a tech website, The Information, said that TikTok was exploring a sale of its US operation without the algorithm. Now, this is a company that's 20% owned by its Chinese founder, but it's actually majority owned by institutional investors. So 60% are owned by them, including some major US companies like the Carlyle Group and General Atlantic.
Victoria Scholar at Interactive Investor, thank you for joining us. You're listening to The Briefing on Monocle Radio. You're back with The Briefing on Monocle Radio with me, Andrew Muller. Time now to get a look at the latest film and TV releases, which will be hitting our screens this weekend or next week, with the TV and culture critic Ashanti Omkar. Ashanti, we're going to start with Challengers, which I believe is out now.
That's right. It is out right now. It's Luca Guadagnino's latest. It's been labeled as a romantic sports film, which I really quite like the way they've labeled that, because it's very rare to find a film that mixes sports with romance. This one is all around tennis, and it has Zendaya in it. Zendaya, obviously, we've seen her kind of become an actress from being a singer. And she's really bringing her A game now. She's getting better and better. She was in Dune 2. She's in the Dune series. And she's literally slaying, as we would say, because she is doing such a great job. And in this one, she stars with Josh O'Connor and Mike Faist. We've seen Josh, obviously, in The Crown. He's a superb actor. And it's really nice to kind of see him doing a role like this. It's a very kind of intense, very sexy film, actually. And Luca Guadagnino always goes for these slightly different topics. And in this case, he's taken the backdrop of tennis for it.
I mean, all romantic comedies, I guess, have to be set somewhere or in some context. But are there lots of laboured analogies between romance and tennis? Are there interminable sequences of jokes based on the double meaning of love, for example, or are we spared that?
This is not a rom-com. This is a romantic sports film. By no means is this a comedy. It will be. I'll be surprised if anyone laughs during this film, because this film has not only a thumping score, but it's a very intense love triangle. And the character of Zendaya is that this is a woman who wants to dominate in some way or the other. And that's, she goes from a young girl who's kind of playing tennis, really good at tennis, finds out that at some point in life she can't, I don't want to give you a spoiler about it, because there's a very big scene there, but at some point in life she realizes she can't continue playing tennis. So what she does is she set her sights on these two guys who are amazing tennis players, with Mike Faist and Josh O'Connor. And Mike is the one, Art Donaldson, and they become the Donaldsons. And the Donaldsons are now here to dominate. And this is not really a comedy at all. You will not see any funny scenes in that sense. It might make you chuckle here and there, but this is a very, very serious film.
Okay, well, let's move along to The Fall Guy. And I am ancient enough that I can remember the actual TV program. And incredibly, I realized earlier, I can still actually just about hum the theme tune.
Ooh, amazing.
I mean, I'm not going to do that, to be clear, but I think it's important for listeners to know that I could if I wish to.
I love that you remember this. This one is an action comedy. So this one is a comedy, and it will make you laugh a lot. This is David Leitch giving us, this look into the world of stunts, and he gives us such a great look. In fact, it's a category that should be lauded more in the world of cinema, and it isn't as much, in action cinema. And this one has the perfect casting, the Barbenheimer duo, as I like to call them, Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt, coming together with Winston Duke, Aaron Taylor-Johnson, who may be our next James Bond, Hannah Waddingham, she's become a national treasure for the UK from her Ted Lasso days, and Stephanie Hsu will make an appearance in it that will make you smile and probably gasp a little bit here and there. This one is really good fun. I have to say that I was already expecting it to be great. It came via SXSW, and I went into this and thought, this is just the type of movie I want to let kind of, you've had a long week, you've been working hard on a Friday night or on the weekend. This is the perfect film. And it comes out on the 2nd of May. So we don't have long to go to watch it.
Would listeners be correct in anticipating a lot of explosions and car accidents?
100%. The car chases are brilliant. The fight sequences are brilliant. And there's a film within the film. So it gives you, it almost kind of immerses you into that action in such a brilliant way.
I mean, obviously, this is a riff on a 1980s TV series. Do they do any sort of side eye to camera meta references to the original Fall Guy, or do they assume at this point that people who are old enough to remember the original Fall Guy are probably a bit past going to see movies with explosions and car chases in them?
Well, there are bits and pieces, but to be honest, this is a completely new film in its own right. And whilst it gives a nod to the old series from the 80s, this one really is you know, it's its own story in its own right. So you'll see little bits here and there, but this is very much in a modern setting.
Well, finally to Shogun, a clip of which we did here at the top of the show. This is streaming now on Disney Plus, so Disney Plus enabled listeners can tune into it as soon as they're done listening to the briefing. Are we recommending this?
We are recommending this very, very highly. This is one of the best series to come out in many years, and it is absolutely fantastic. You can now binge the whole thing. So it has just, you know, they were giving it to us in rips and drabs every week, and now finally you've got the finale has come out. So now you can watch it in one shot. And I'll just have to say to you, binging this is the best way to consume it. It looks into a piece of history. You know, it's very interesting because, you know, I certainly didn't know that there was a young man from Kent in the UK who goes to Japan and then becomes tied up in feudal Japan in such a way. And we get to really experience Japanese culture. You'll be heading for your matcha tea and you'll want to do all those things when you're watching this and after you're watching it. I would say maybe go and do some shopping en route so that you can sit and binge this in one shot.
So you're suggesting people perhaps could equip themselves with the necessary cuisine, perhaps even the costumes. I'm just having ideas over here.
I mean, if you're into cosplay, you might like to do that. This is so beautifully crafted. You know, it's going to jump out at you in your homes. I always wish that I saw this as a long extended movie. I spent a whole day watching this on the big screen. It is really that beautiful.
Well, that does bring me to the final question I wanted to ask about Shogun. James Clavell's original novel is one of those proper sort of 20,000-page doorstoppers. Obviously, there is a sense of the epic about this story. Does that come across even if you are watching it on a television, however hefty that television may be?
Absolutely, it does. I can tell you that even if you saw this on your tiny screen, and I don't recommend that because you won't get that experience, but even if you saw it on your phone screen, because they've got a lot of beautiful close-ups, this is what makes, you know, something like this work for television so well. You can give it that long form, and also the way they've shot it, the cinematography is just absolutely beautiful, and you will be drawn to it on whatever size screen you watch it.
Ashanti Omkar, thank you very much for joining us. You are listening to The Briefing. You are back with The Briefing on Monocle Radio. Good news has been in such short supply for Boeing of late that they're probably pretty content at this point with news which is not quite as bad as they expected. Boeing's first bunch of quarterly results for 2024 reveal that persistent problems with their 737 MAX aircraft have indeed had an impact, causing Boeing to burn through near enough to $4 billion, though this was $500 million less than they had been braced for. Boeing shares remain disinclined to take off, however, down more than 34% since the beginning of the year. Well, joining me now is Anita Mandarata, a special advisor to the Secretary General of the United Nations World Tourism Organization, and who also runs a global management consultancy specializing in tourism and development. Anita, is it fair then to say that the problems with 737 MAX have registered with airline passengers?
Indeed. And firstly, thank you very, very much for having me. I'm very grateful, and I'm grateful for the focus on this. The 737 MAX has indeed put the spotlight on Boeing with travelers and investors in a way that Boeing definitely did not want. It's been a very difficult 5 years for them, and the last 4 months have been particularly challenging. And as you've rightly called out, the FAA in the US has actually put a production cap on the 737 MAX, which has again made travelers very nervous, as normally we're not talking about the manufacturers, we're speaking about airlines. And now the boardroom conversations have gone to the dining rooms with travelers themselves.
I mean, are people miscalibrating the risks here? There is that old joke in journalism about how nobody ever wrote a headline story about a plane that took off and landed just like it was supposed to. Airline and aircraft mishaps do attract a disproportionate amount of attention for obvious reasons. How many people are really starting to think about whether or not they really want to fly on a 737 MAX?
You're absolutely right. The natural drama of any footage that we see about airlines in trouble, especially when it comes through social media and what Boeing has experienced, elevates the anxiety around air travel as a whole. So it actually goes beyond the 737 and beyond Boeing. It impacts the traveler's perception of the safety of airline travel per se. Research was conducted just before Easter this year with over 2,000 UK adults asking exactly what you just inquired on. And very sadly, almost 33%, so almost a third of those interviewed, are saying that they're losing trust in air travel. So again, this goes beyond Boeing. It impacts Airbus, which is ultimately the largest share of airline manufacturing, Boeing having 40%, Airbus 60%. But it's making people anxious. And for the first time in a long time, travelers are actually looking at not just what their airline they want to travel on, but the aircraft that airline actually utilizes. This is unnatural. 16% are checking the actual aircraft type. And it's only going to get worse, I fear.
Do Boeing appear to have any ideas about how to restore trust? So I guess I'm asking, is there any readily understood industry template for this kind of thing? Because it's not the first time that an aircraft manufacturer or an airline has had to reassure passengers. Accidents do happen.
Indeed. You are absolutely right. And sadly, accidents do happen, as they do with train travel and with car travel. Unfortunately, however, this, again, as I say, covers all airlines per se. An interesting aspect of the airline industry is that as much as the airlines and the aircraft manufacturers will compete on many elements, they will never compete on pricing. I beg your pardon, on safety. That is one area they will never compete on. So when we look at what's happening in terms of travelers themselves and the airlines, they're proceeding with caution. Boeing in particular has the internal challenges and the solutions they need to find, which starts ultimately with leadership. They were given by the US government 90 days back at the end of February to come up with a very clear plan for safety and transparency that they need to communicate. In addition, as you know well, there have been very significant leadership changes within Boeing itself. But then when we look externally, what Boeing is needing to very much be transparent about is changes in culture, putting safety and quality ahead of profit, and changes of ethics of leaderships, linked very much to what I've just shared, and in commitment to travelers to ensuring that they can have the peace of mind going forward. This is something that is now an expectation of both the industry and the travelers themselves, as well as investors. So Boeing has quite a significant to-do list to focus on at all levels, from the point of view of industry, travelers, and investors.
Hey, just finally, I did mention introducing this that Boeing shares have tanked fairly dramatically since the start of this year, and this has been going on for a while. Does that reflect an amount of nervousness from the markets that the 737 MAX may not be out of the woods yet? Because one or two more mishaps and the problems start to look a bit terminal with that aircraft, don't they?
Indeed. And again, it's the aircraft, but also it's aviation per se. I think it's also putting this in context that you and I are travelers. We were grounded for many years because of the pandemic, and there were over 14,000 commercial aircraft grounded. This is the first year we've had the blessing of seeing aviation routes being established. And so with Boeing having to ground many of its 737s, with 737 production being capped, that means that global travel is being held back in terms of the ability to provide the capacity that the world needs to get traveling again, and for cargo as well. What does this mean for us as travelers? Difficulty in getting our actual seats in terms of being able to book where we want to go when, increases in pricing, and as you've called out, the increases in anxiety. So it's going to be a very challenging year for Boeing and for all of us in the flying public. So we need to keep an eye on this, and I'm grateful that you are keeping Monocle's eye on this.
Anita Mandarata, thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to The Briefing on Monocle Radio. And that is all for this edition of The Briefing. It was produced by Tom Webb. Our researcher was George Ruskin, and our studio manager was Tamsin Howard. The Briefing returns on Monday at the same time. I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening.